Autobiography of a Yogi. This is class number 1 out of 12 with Asha Praver, July 10th, 2001.
Welcome, everyone. I'm just delighted that you're all here to do this. I am also. I did, after doing Master Swami's book on Hindu Way of Awakening, and then we did God Alone. Then we went into money and marriage, which are all very, very fine and interesting, but I'm kind of glad to be back into something a little less practical or a little less sort of application-oriented and more into the essence. It is always an adventure to read this book. Doesn't matter how many times you've read it, whether it's the first or the 30th or the 50th time. You start reading it again, and there's just always something new. And this time particularly, somehow, when I read these first three chapters, I could just somehow imagine what it must feel like to a person who's reading it for the first time. You know, it's just such a stunning story. The way that we'll work with this is pretty simple. I passed out these notes last week, and we'll have them again for you this week. I must say, these are all notes I made in 1992. My version still has my date on them. Maybe yours does or doesn't. So it's not like these were just the fruit of just recent reading. And all I really tried to do in the notes was just sort of summarize the main points. And in some cases, in fact, as we get more into some of the later chapters, some of the questions were more provocative. But mostly it's just to sort of help us remember. So I won't necessarily read from them. It's just to help you also understand, pick up the main points. We can do this in several ways. I can just ramble on, which I will. And also, I'm happy to have you ask questions, as we've always done in these classes. If some particular aspect of the chapter you really want to have elucidated or struck you as important or something like that, we'll pause from time to time and work with that. We are doing approximately three chapters a week, just because we only have 12 weeks. When we did this class before in 1992, it took us 2 years. Because we just did a chapter at a time. There's something like 48 chapters. Must have taken us longer than 2 years, come to think of it. But that was, we just went on every Monday with a whole different world then. But we went on for a really long time. It was really great doing it that way. So this will be a little rushed, and plus we're only doing some of it. But I think it'll still be worth doing. You think so? Are there any questions or comments or thoughts before we launch in? This class is recorded despite the curse of the mummy. We will record it. So if you miss any of the classes, you can get a tape. And also, we do have in advance which chapters we're reading each week. So if you just want to drop in and out, of course, you can catch up that way. All right. I'm not on the loudspeaker. Were you wanting me to? No, I'm not. So I just am going to have to speak up. We couldn't get the system working. So there's no microphone. I'm just recording off the little mic here. So I'll speak up as loud as I can. So if you really lose me, just raise your hand. One of the reasons we come in here is so that I'll have the loudspeaker, but there you have it. When I was meditating, reflecting on what these early chapters are about, there's so much that's so interesting because, of course, Master wrote it according to divine inspiration, not by calculation. I know when Swamiji does or writes things and so on, he doesn't necessarily know when he starts exactly where he's going. He just knows intuitively every piece of it is correct. So some of the patterns are sort of there after you're done. And I was reflecting on the first and second chapter of this book, or about two things that are really fundamental to Yogananda's entire mission. And that is Divine Mother. And the second is the perfectly balanced householder life. Bearing in mind that Yogananda came to really launch a new age of spirituality, and literally the changing of the yugas on the planet. Many of you know, and it's a footnote later on in this book, talking about this 24,000-year cycle of ascending and descending ages on planet Earth, and our having just begun in 1799, 1800, the beginning, the sort of introductory part, and now we're more well into it, Dwapara Yuga, which is the age of energy. And we've come out of the age of matter, which is Kali Yuga, and we're into the age of energy, And more than that, we're on an ascending cycle. The last master to influence the West, which is really Jesus, was in Kali Yuga going down, the materialistic age and getting worse, which is really a pretty grim prospect. I think probably a lot of us were there then. It wasn't grim for this reason. In Kali Yuga going down, you got to just say, forget the whole thing, and just walk out into the desert and just go into a cave, because society as a whole was just on such a low level from the point of view of refinement and spiritual consciousness that there was no hope of reconciling a true dedication to God with anything that resembled normal involvement in society. So that's why the whole tradition of Christianity, starting with the desert fathers, who just, like St. Anthony and the others, just went out as far as they could from civilization. The story of St. Anthony is just truly remarkable, as he talks about he went, you know, to this cave, which was so remote, and then people found him, so he walked farther into the desert, and he found a more remote cave, and then farther into the desert, and he found a more remote one, and finally went down into an old Egyptian tomb and spent another 10 or 20 years there. I mean, he spent 60, 70, 80, I don't know how many years, but decades, just by himself meditating. I mean, that was like his sadhana, because it was Kali Yuga descending. It was just coming to pieces. He actually only came out of that when word came to him that Christians were being crucified and thrown to the lions and martyred in many other ways. And also he came out of it because there was a big controversy in the church as to the true nature of Jesus' incarnation. And they called St. Anthony out to help solve it. Because bear in mind, everything is disintegrating. People's ability to perceive subtle truth is getting worse and worse. So you have Jesus come, who is a fully realized master. Now, all I'm talking about when I say people's consciousness is I'm talking about the planet as a whole. You know, when Jesus was crucified, it wasn't anything special that Jesus was crucified. That's basically how they got rid of anyone that they didn't like. And people were crucified on the open highway. That's where they were crucified, so everybody else could see by example. Now, barbaric as this age may be in certain ways, it's just not likely that they're going to crucify people along El Camino. It's just the planet as a whole has gone up from that. But that was just common. That was just the way life was run because it was just a very, very gross age. So when Anthony was called back, there was this controversy about whether or not Jesus was the full incarnation of the divine or whether he was just a man. And there was this huge, they called him to this service, and it had to do with the recitation of the creed. And when the creed was starting to be recited, the way the story is told, pandemonium broke out, and both sides of the controversy started shouting at each other. And Anthony stood up in the middle and simply said, "I have seen him." And his power of his direct perception, and simply said, "I have seen him." And his power of his direct perception of Christ was so strong that it entirely silenced the controversy, and the controversy ended on the side of Christ as the divine. When I was talking in an unrelated way to a friend of mine who's an Episcopal priest, about certain aspects of Jesus' teaching, actually what it was I noticed in a rereading of the Bible that Jesus had all his followers collected into small communities. And it occurred to me that Jesus must have taught intentional communities, because that's what they all did. Just as Yogananda taught the concept of intentional communities. So I asked my priest friend about it, and he started explaining to me about they thought the world was going to end, and they got together because they thought it was the end of the world, and he started talking about various, basically complete misunderstandings of Jesus' true message, and about how the Christian teaching had evolved over several centuries. And I said, you know, that's not possible. Jesus was a fully realized master. Time didn't have to pass for it to get better and better. In fact, what happened is it gradually got destroyed because it was Kali Yuga going down. And he sort of got this wonderful look on his face that I'm accustomed to. And just sort of, you know, he has a divinity degree from Yale. He just talked about sort of what's happened to him since he got involved with Ananda. He didn't mean it negatively. He just meant, you know, it really looks different from this point of view. Meaning from the way Paramhansa Yogananda has resurrected it. Because he described his teaching as the second coming of Christ. Some people wonder if that really literally means that he is Christ returned. And some people think he might be. But in any case, he's the restoration of the true teachings of Christianity, and that was his job. Master said that Babaji and Christ commissioned him, you know, from the East and the West, to bring back the original teachings of Krishna and the original teachings of Christianity, and to restore to the West especially, but really to the whole planet, the teachings that have been lost, because they had to, you know, they've all gone through this long, dark tunnel of Kali Yuga, in which they've sort of been squeezed a lot by the cosmic inability of the planet to hold it together. You know, the institutions, authorities, all the different things that happen. Great souls are great souls, and they appear in the midst of all of this. They just do different things. When Jesus is, you know, closest, most dynamic followers, there wasn't much point in trying to create something for society at that point, because society was just heading downhill. So what they did is they withdrew into the monasteries and created it and kept it alive through the Dark Ages by being isolated from the culture. Now we're into Dwapara Yuga. Now we're just coming out of all of that, and that's what you see all around you. It's manifested in every attitude, in everything that you see. Swamiji, once sitting in a room like this, said, you know, virtually everything in this room no one could have created it, you know, 150 years ago. Just all the synthetic materials, the way the building is constructed, just probably most of the clothes we're wearing, just everything. It just couldn't have been done, because there's just been a revolution in a very, very recent period of time. So oftentimes a master comes to help make these transitions, because there's a lot of inertia from the past, and there's a lot of lack of clarity as to where we're actually going. Krishna came when it was going from Dwapara Yuga into Kali Yuga. It was on its way down. The age that we're just entering, because there's a circle that goes like this, and it descends on one side and ascends on the other, and then is even across like that. Just depends on which way it's heading. So Krishna was in Dwapara Yuga heading down into Kali Yuga, and he was having to teach people what it was going to be like in the next age, because even then avatars are required. And one of the things that Krishna had to do was, for example, in the great war of the Mahabharata, when Arjuna and his brothers were fighting against the dark force, Krishna was guiding them in what they had to do. And there was a very powerful warrior named Drona. And Drona was so powerful, he'd been the guru of all the both sides, because they were cousins. And Drona was so powerful, he was just wreaking havoc to Arjuna and their army. And Krishna says, we have to get rid of Drona, and he's too powerful for us to defeat him directly. And he said, the only way we can defeat Drona, this is Krishna saying this, is that if he believes his son, whose name was Ashwatthama, if he believes his beloved son has been killed, he will lose heart for the fight and he won't fight anymore. So he went to Yudhishthira, who was the oldest of the righteous side of Arjuna and his brothers. And Yudhishthira was so pure, they say, that his chariot was always 2 inches off the ground, because he was such a pure soul, he didn't quite come all the way to earth. And Krishna told Yudhishthira that he would have to lie to Drona. He would have to tell a lie to Drona and tell him that his son was killed, otherwise the good side could not win. And this was so horrifying to everyone, that an honorable person like Yudhishthira would have to lie, never lied in his life, and that Krishna, the Lord himself, was telling him to do it. So Yudhishthira had to go and say to Drona, Ashwatthama is dead. And then he said to himself, because they had killed an elephant of the same name, the elephant. But nonetheless, Yudhishthira's chariot hit the ground, and ever thereafter it was on the ground. But they said to Krishna, why do you have us lie? He said, the age is getting darker, he said, and darkness is so strong that we have to use a little bit of the techniques of the dark to defeat it. It's just a new age. And then there were several other instances I won't go into, which Arjuna, Krishna himself, did dishonorable things unheard of before Kali Yuga. But Krishna was setting the tone. I mean, these are maybe apocryphal stories, maybe mythological stories, but the point being, the time was changing. Yogananda came, fortunately for us, at the time when it's going up. And so he's trying to break with this book and with this whole mission, he's trying to break pretty much all of our subconscious habits and thoughts about spirituality. He's setting an entire new tone. And we just very, very vaguely understand the sort of degree of that revolution. And I watch myself, and I watch many of you all and other friends of mine over all these years. We just keep carrying our subconscious stories forward. You know, we carry our Catholicism, we carry our Judaism, we carry our atheism, we carry our materialism. We just keep carrying it forward. And only little by little can we even slightly grasp sort of the magnitude of the revolution that's being asked of us. Now, there's many, many levels which, you know, we can hardly begin, and we will just as we go through these chapters, touching it. But one of the profound and powerful things Yogananda brought, which is a keynote of his entire mission, is God as Divine Mother. Now, it's very important to appreciate that because it is so fundamental. Very often, newcomers here will protest. I don't get this protest nearly as much as I used to. Maybe the sort of mood has passed. Why are there no women on the altar? You know, because they'll look at the pictures of the masters and they'll think they're all men. Of course, they're no more men than women, but they're just, there they are. And they do look sort of more male for the most part, and probably if you actually looked at them, they had real bodies, and they were male bodies. But it's all a delusion to the soul anyway, it doesn't matter. But even without, you know, the presence of women on the altar, this particular teaching is entirely dedicated to the ideal of a motherly image of the divine. But that's not really about gender, lest sort of the women in the crowd feel it's an affirmation of feminism. It's not that at all. What he's talking about is an intimate, personal relationship with the divine. And there really is no mother per se or father per se. It's just our own mind's way of understanding sort of what that message is that's so far beyond everything. And so we have this thought. Yogananda said, in his own voice, we have a tape of him saying, worship God as mother, because the mother is much closer than the father. And then he also says, I love this phrase, he said, pray to God as mother. He can't resist you when you do that. Right? Which is giving you the idea that it really makes no difference whether we're talking he or she. The pronoun is not the point.